Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, extraordinaire, Matthew Leyland.
I like that. Can I have that added, please?
Should we put that in the flannel panel?
Yes, it will take up an inordinate amount of space, but I think it's worth it.
Okay, I'll add that this week. Okay, so this week we are reviewing Franchise Closer, or is it, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, and we'll be talking to the cast of that. We're also looking at animation Ruby Gilman Teenage Kraken, documentary Wham, and Sarah Snook's chiller Run, Rabbit, Run. But before we do get onto those, what else have you been clapping your eyes on, Matthew?
Well, last night I watched a film that's coming up in a few weeks on Sky called Maggie Moores. That's an S in brackets. And that's got John Hamm in it, being directed by his old Mad Men colleague, John Slattery. It's a comedy noir. It also stars Tina Fey, which I kind of enjoyed. Feels like a small screen experience. Yeah, very, very pleasant surprise. Not great, not perfect, but very watchable.
Mm. I was watching Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny at the premiere, and then got to have a little drink at the premiere party, which was very nice.
Nice.
Rub shoulders with the famous, see them have a little drink of a spicy margarita. Maz was there, Phoebe was there, her partner Martin McDonagh was there, Stephen Merchant was there, various famous folk, influencers, that man with the long hair.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very interesting. So that's what I was watching. I was people watching.
Was Harrison there then?
He did pop in briefly
and
popped out again, but they were doing the junket the next day. So I think they were all trying not to get headaches, and our very own Molly Edwards sat down with them. So we'll be listening to that in a second. Shall we get on then? I mean, Indiana Jones is something that everyone's very much anticipating. So I guess we should really crack the whip and get on with it.
Hitler made mistakes, and with this, I will correct them all.
You stole it.
Then you stole it.
And then I stole it. It's called capitalism.
This way!
Fasten your seatbelt. There might be some turbulence.
You've taken your chances, made your mistakes, and now a final triumph.
Indiana Jones.
A few times in my life I've seen things.
I've been tortured with voodoo. Been shot 9 times. Including once by your father.
Sorry.
But I've been looking for this all my life.
So this is Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. So Matthew, what is the Dial of Destiny, and where do we find Dr. Jones?
Well, the Dial of Destiny, I mean, it's kind of shrouded in secrecy. We don't want to say too much, but as has been kind of gradually revealed over the last few months, it is to do with time, with specifically fissures in time. So that comes very much into play in the movie. But I mean, essentially, it's another MacGuffin. It's like the Ark, it's like the Holy Grail, the Sankara stones. And so Indy's on the trail of this, a trail which starts in the 40s in this extended prologue where we see a de-aged Harrison Ford, where he comes first into contact with Mads Mikkelsen's Nazi villain. And then after this prologue, we cut to 1969. Indy's 70. He's about to retire from being a professor. His life's kind of in tatters. His personal life's in looking quite tatty. It feels like he's hung up his hat. But then a Phoebe Waller-Bridge's character, his goddaughter Helena, she arrives on the scene and draws him into this mystery, which does again bring him into contact with Mads Mikkelsen's villain and on the trail of the Dial of Destiny. And he just stays in the same apartment. It's completely different from all the other indie films. Stays in the same apartment. He doesn't put on his hat, doesn't get his ball wet. But of course he doesn't. He goes all over the world with all his accoutrements. He goes under the sea, in the air, on land. There's lots of chases. It's very much, it's an indie movie, essentially.
It is. Shall we have a listen to what the cast had to say then when Molly sat down with them to talk about this possible final installment?
This film is all about time travel, and in that spirit, reflecting on the past, why would you say that Dial of Destiny is the perfect way to cap off the incredible legacy of these films?
Because it's been going on for 42 years, and during that time, things have changed. And age is about time. And it's been 15 years since we made one of these movies, and I've changed a bit. I've grown older. In the earlier four films, they were made close enough to each other, so it wasn't such a big part of the story. But I always wanted to visit Indiana Jones towards the end of his career, towards the end of his life, and see the result of all of the things that all of the adventures that we've had with him come to a kind of emotional conclusion. And so Jim developed a script that revolved around time and its many different aspects of it, which was really a wonderful adventure. And I was thrilled to have the chance to revisit the character again and to bring another story to the people who have been so supportive of the films that we've made up to this point.
I think time is at the very essence of every single Indiana Jones film there's been, because it's about the relationship between the past and the present, and then in turn the future as well. And I think that this film in particular brings that like all together, and like Indy confronts his relationship with time in terms of past and history, but also his own life. And I think that's sort of a beautiful bringing together of all the themes that have been through all the films.
They're both so eloquent. I think that all I'd add is that I don't think it's a movie about time travel, but like Phoebe and Harrison said, it's a movie about time and the past and the present and the future and the toll that our lives take on us of both achievements and regrets. Whether we're a hero or a regular Joe, we all wrestle with our lives, and our lives are a thread from then till now.
And one of the other things about this movie is that this is about family. This is about a family that, you know, there's some bumps in the road here that have the opportunity to be addressed. At the end of one's life, or towards the ends of one's life, you consider all of these things, you know, you want to set things right. I think we want to leave this character knowing not that he's going to be all right, but he did the right thing, and the right thing happened to him. I'm really going to encourage people to go to see this movie in a theater with their family, as far from your refrigerator as you can get. Go into a place with strangers. Watch something together that's laughs and joy and heart, and feel your common humanity.
Harrison, you must have so many amazing memories from filming all of these movies, but what would you say is like your favorite memory or moment from filming Dial of Destiny?
Waking up in 1969. I don't want to explain what that means, but look for it in the movie, you'll see what I mean. It's a moment that has been purposefully crafted. It's just great movie making. And I don't want to describe it.
Well, we knew when we shot that scene, it was pretty early. We shot all the scenes in Indy's apartment pretty early in the schedule. And I think both Harrison and I looked at each other and knew after we did a couple takes of that scene that Harrison is describing. And there's just this moment where you go, oh, that's the movie. And you go, like, it's just some moment that you feel like everyone in the orchestra is harmonized and this thing sounds and feels like what the whole thing has to feel like. And it gives you a kind of feather to hold on to as you march forward on the next 150 days of shooting this piece.
So that is the gang talking Indy 5. Matthew, this is long awaited. It's supposed to cap off the series. Harrison Ford is not getting any younger, even though he's playing 70. He's actually 80 in real life.
It's not the years, it's the mileage.
So this is the last outing. How does it fare as a hat tip goodbye send-off?
It's quite hard to judge on a first viewing. I mean, to kind of give it the benefit of the doubt, I would see it again. But on first viewing, I was very, very disappointed with it as a huge, huge indie fan. You know, since the very beginning, one of my absolute favorite franchises, Harrison Ford, one of my favorite movie stars. I found this all a bit hollow. It feels very much like an indie film. It kind of ticks all the boxes. But I felt it really lacked the kind of the wonder and the charm and the humor and the scares of the Spielberg directed ones, apart from Crystal Skull. But certainly in comparison with the original trilogy, I mean, I didn't hate it. I wasn't bored exactly. I kind of went along with it. But on reflection, after I came out, I felt like it hadn't really been the game changer I was hoping for.
Yeah, I mean, they've set it up, and in our cover feature, when we talk to the filmmakers and the cast, they set it up very much as a final bow out, and one that really does justice to the legacy of Indiana Jones in terms of matching those films. And I agree with you, I just don't think it does. And that's for a number of reasons. It makes, you know, some additions which are very good. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is incredibly good as Helena. You know, very engaging, charismatic, and really goes toe-to-toe with Harrison Ford and with her little quips. She drives the story, essentially. Without her, this would be nothing. But the issues are the item and how it performs in the final third of the film is truly Crystal Skull-level stupid. And the other issue I have with it is in a film series that where we so enjoyed the physicality of it. So watching Harrison Ford ride horses and fall off them, watching Terry Leonard do that amazing stunt where he went under the truck and was dragged along and pulled out the bullwhip and climbed back on, where we really felt viscerally that we were watching this happen. This is so CGI heavy, so unbelievable and uncanny valley. It's clearly a lot of face mapping. There's a chase through the streets of a Moroccan town on tuk-tuks that is like a video game, and you feel no danger whatsoever because it's clearly not happening for real at all.
Yeah.
And then there's Harrison Ford doing his world-weary and sardonic, which he has always done, which is what we love about him.
Mm-hmm.
Now it feels like it's really world-weary and sardonic, and that he just really can't be arsed with it. So that sort of verve has gone for me a little bit. So yeah, it just didn't quite match up. You know, you mentioned an underwater sequence, and for me, that's when this film actually came alive, when, you know, we stopped faffing about with Boyd Holbrook chasing him down in the streets of New York, and we actually started doing exploring, and we actually started with Antonio Banderas totally getting the register of this. He turns up as this, I am a Spanish diver. I am, you know, he just like, he gets the tone completely, and he's off, and he is bringing all of this joy to it. And then we start to globetrot, and we have those maps with the little dots,
red line,
that stuff you love. But I will say, there is an orchestral note throughout that tells you where this is going. There is a dun, 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 kind of, I'll just say that. There's a little note that you hear throughout that indicates where it's going. So if you get to this point and you haven't twigged what's going on, you might be astonished. Otherwise, you think throughout the film, oh, we're not doing that, are we? And then we arrive there and you're like, oh, We are doing that. And so that's for me where the disappointment lies. Good stuff, though. I mean, obviously, I've just talked about the bad stuff there. Good stuff for you, Matthew?
Well, the score, I mean, it's impossible to resist the Raiders march every time, you know, every time it comes to the fore. You know, they do use it quite a lot. They're not sparing with it. So, I mean, John Williams is on his game, as usual. Like you said, I mean, Ford, I mean, he's so watchable. I mean, he is simply one of the great movie stars. He's still got that charisma. He looks fantastic. And Phoebe Waller-Bridge, she kind of brings like a fresh energy to it. She's not like a character we've seen before. She's not like one of his previous sidekicks. So that's really nice to have. But yeah, it just the word that always, I keep thinking of just hollow, really, in comparison. Like, I mean, I didn't mind the ending. It's kind of outlandish, but I didn't feel it was any more outlandish than some of the other endings of the films. But it just feels like it doesn't really carry the weight it's supposed to. It feels like you're supposed to be really awed and swept away. But, I mean, I just kind of thought of Bill and Ted, really.
Yes. It totally is. Yeah.
What came to mind.
Yes. And I think it feels very much like they're really reaching for you to be emotionally moved by it. And I dry-eyed. You know, there's callbacks, there's certain characters that turn up, there's certain refrains of scenes we've seen before in the series that are designed to absolutely button push. And it just left me cold. When I think to something like Maverick that does this so perfectly, so well, marrying that. Where is this character now? Where is Pete Mitchell now? What does it mean to be him, having had this adventure in his earlier life? How is he failing? How is he succeeding? And how are you putting all of those fan favorite aspects into the film while also carrying it forward? Gold star for Maverick, Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Please see the teacher.
Sorry, Indy.
It's just a shame, especially as Harrison Ford did so well reprising his other key characters with Han Solo in The Force Awakens and then Deckard in Blade Runner 2049, when you really kind of hoped for a hat trick, but it doesn't kind of follow from those movies. It just doesn't kind of have what those movies had, the way they handled him. And it's also a shame because it feels like they're trying to make up for Crystal Skull, really. I feel like if Crystal Skull had performed better, if that had been a more solid ending to the saga, which it felt like at the time, they probably wouldn't have gone on with this one. But really, I felt it was kind of on a par with Crystal Skull, to be honest. And if anything, you know, perhaps just left me even more kind of nonplussed, I have to say, because at least you did have a few Spielbergian sparkles in that movie, whereas this, it sort of trundles along. I mean, I like James Mangold as a director, but I feel like he just doesn't really grasp the kind of magic of what makes Indy so special, really.
Well, Spielberg disagrees because he said he thought no one else could do it but him, but he thinks that Mangold has achieved it. I think we could probably say that there are people that will go and see this weekend and be thrilled by it, won't they?
Yeah. And like I say, I'd be totally willing to watch it again. I mean, I've seen all the others multiple times, and I did go in with very high expectations. So I'd be willing to give it another chance, but I do suspect it won't stand up against those earlier movies. And I probably won't be watching it that many times in years to come.
Yeah. And also there's this very sort of strange Nazi thing whereby Nazis, all of their sort of motivation and the reason for killing them is just, well, they're Nazis. There's nothing beyond that. And so I don't know that, like, when you think about Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Nazis in that, they were driven by something other than being Nazis. Belloc is a complicated character.
Yeah.
He is, you know, in cahoots with the Nazis, just, you know, that happens to be a thing. That isn't what drives him. And to defeat him isn't just to defeat Nazis. It's to defeat something wider and larger. And it feels like with this, it's very much because Nazis. So, yeah, I think perhaps there needed to be a little more time taken on actual storytelling, but also just wish they'd all sat down and gone, right, Crystal Skull, aliens, that was a bit silly. What do you think about this one? Is this as silly? Show of hands. Because it feels like that wasn't considered, that actually maybe taking it smaller and more emotionally involved and more of a personal story might have been the better way to go than this crazy final third.
And just a bit shorter. It's so long. I mean, it's 2.5 hours, which feels like, I really felt like the prologue just felt excessively long. It just felt like it went on and on and on. And I just wanted to get to real Harrison Ford, not de-aged Harrison Ford. I mean, you kind of compare that with the young indie prologue of Last Crusade. I mean, that's so charming and witty and funny. And you've got River Phoenix doing this perfect Harrison Ford impersonation.
And but fast. Kind of that is done and dusted. Yeah.
Yeah, they speed through it. They get the job done. It's like a perfect lead in, but this, it just felt like a digital effects showcase, really.
Yeah. And also, it's quite interesting that it shares a lot of similarities with another big blockbuster that's coming out, Mission Impossible. As we've seen from the trailer and sort of pap shots of that, there's also a fight on a train with that. There's, you know, shenanigans that could be equated in sort of the streets of Rome to the tuk-tuk chase in this. And for my money, I feel like one of those is going to be better than the other. We can't say yet, but it does feel like... Yes, but it does feel that it will take money. It will be a hit.
Yeah.
Of course it will. Yeah. And it will satisfy people and satisfy a certain itch. But I think if you actually go away and think about any of it, you'll be like, hang on, if that had happened, wouldn't archaeologists have found that? And how could that? And then, and you don't want to be thinking that when you're watching an Indiana Jones film. You just want to be swept up in it. And I wasn't swept up. However, I think I would say absolutely go and see it. It's one of those films that you need to see in order to have an idea about and to have a comment on whether you love it or hate it.
For hours.
Yes, and there will be people in both camps. So I think we could highly recommend that you go and see it, regardless of what you think of it.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you fancy Indiana Jones, Indy 5, it's out in cinemas on Friday. Right, there's underwater adventure in Indy. There's more underwater adventure with this.
What? Your mother never told you you were royalty? The women in our family have the mighty power to turn into giant kraken.
What now?
Ruby, you're a princess. Address the crowd.
I think I am having a panic attack.
So this is Ruby Gilman, teenage kraken. Ruby Gilman is a teenage kraken, I assume, Matthew.
Yes, that's totally 100% medically factually accurate. It's kind of similar to where we had last year, Turning Red. We had a teenage girl turning into a giant red panda and discovering her family heritage of pandaness. This is Kraken. So Ruby Gilman, she is your kind of typical teenage girl. She's struggling to fit in at school. But then there's an incident where she goes to save a boy who falls into the sea, and she discovers that she's a Kraken. So she suddenly expands to enormous size, has... she's got laser eyes, she's got tentacles that light up, and then she kind of learns more about her family past, and that there's this ongoing historical conflict with mermaids. So in a way, this is kind of like, it's either a dig at or like the opposite of the Little Mermaid. So it's very well timed off the back of Disney's live action Little Mermaid, because in this one the mermaids are apparently the baddies. So we've got this Krakens versus mermaids within the context of a coming of age story. It's a bit sort of Teen Wolf as well,
which is no bad thing. You're selling it well. If you're saying Turning Red and Teen Wolf, I'm there for it. Does it work as well as those?
Well, no, I would say not. No, especially compared to Turning Red. I think it's quite unfortunate it's followed quite so closely. It's perfectly watchable. It's kind of innocuous. It's a big family movie where all the main characters are female. So you've got the grandmother played by Jane Fonda. She's sort of the big kind of the matriarch. Lana Condor plays Ruby Gilman, and you've got Toni Collette playing Ruby's mum. So you've got all these big names in this mix. But I just found it just really kind of anodyne. It's kind of sad that we sort of take for granted now computer animation. It looks very pretty and sparkly and colourful, but it really doesn't do anything more than any other kind of CGI movie of recent times. It doesn't kind of push the boundaries. Although there's some nice character design. They've got these kind of nice sort of floppy limbs that are quite expressive and fun. Yeah, but I didn't find it particularly funny or moving or exciting.
Oh, dear.
I know, a bit of a towner. So, I mean, I think it'll play decently to family audiences. It's not too long. It's quite a nice sort of tidy 91 minutes. I mean, I don't know about you, but I found Little Mermaid just a bit too long, really. I found that kind of excessively long.
We seem to say that about loads of films, don't we? We are constantly complaining that they're too long.
They are too long.
Why? Why did they go on and on?
I don't know. I mean, it's not surely not good for cinemas to have all these films playing such a long time. Maybe it's because of Avatar. Perhaps it's the Avatar effect and the Marvel movies. They're all 2 hours plus and they're always massive hits. Perhaps that's people think you need a big running time. It kind of suggests that it's kind of weighty and important. I don't know. But yeah, but anyway, that is one of the positives about this, that it's short. But I'm kind of struggling to say any more positives.
Oh, dear. So, I mean, are you suggesting that this is one to avoid and maybe wait for streaming? Is it worth taking your young girls to the cinema to see this, to sort of see a coming-of-age story? I mean, it is important to sort of see these stories told and for there to be stories about young women that they can see themselves reflected on screen. So from that point of view, I guess it's important that it exists.
Yeah. Oh, but totally.
But a shame then that it doesn't quite match up to the panda woes of Turning Red.
No, I mean, I was such a big fan of that film.
Me too.
I just kept thinking of it all the way through this one, how that did everything better, like when she discovers that she is this, she has this alternate persona as a giant creature, and the handling of the kind of all the metaphors for adolescence and growing up and growing pains and one's relationship with one's mother, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I think Turning Red got there first and did it so much better. I took my 9-year-old son. He enjoyed it well enough. I think it will kind of go down okay with families. I think there's certainly worse films out there. It's totally inoffensive. It's got a nice sort of bubbly soundtrack as well. So, yeah, I wouldn't unrecommend it, but I'm not strongly recommending it.
He's not unrecommending it, ladies and gentlemen.
High praise, isn't it? Thank praise, clap.
There we go. So if you fancy having a go on Ruby Gilman, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time to wake me up before you go with this. Well, bam,
I am a man. Let's introduce the band.
George. I'm Andrew.
We had a number one album. We had a string of hit singles. And we were selling out arenas.
How can the country be in love with these two idiots?
We met when I was 11 and Andrew was 12.
And there was only ever one thing that I wanted to do. You get so be in a band with George.
Andrew changed my life in exactly the way someone needed to change my life if I was going to be a pop star.
And that was it. Wham!
So this is Wham! Exclamation mark, because why not? It's the 80s. A documentary about George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley and how they came together to create Wham! Such a huge group in the 80s.
Oh, heartthrobs, yeah.
Tiny, tiny shorts, you know, stadium tours, the whole shebang. So, Matthew, what does this film do that hasn't been sort of uncovered before?
Yeah, like you say, I mean, they had such a massive, massive impact. And they were only together 4 years. It's kind of hard to believe. It was 82 to 86 they were together. I mean, yeah, the Wham! Story's been told before. We've had lots of George Michael documentaries before. But this, I think it really harnesses the kind of the meteoric rise to fame that they had, how it was such a rush. When they had a few struggles at the start. They had a couple of songs that didn't even chart in the official charts, kind of scraping the bottom of like the top 100. But then all of a sudden, like one after one Top of the Pops appearance, it was kind of off to the races and they just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it really sort of captures that kind of exhilarating rush, and especially in George Michael's case, as he became better known as a songwriter and a pop star in his own right, and how they went on. I mean, they played in China at a time when Western pop acts weren't playing in China. They were absolutely had a huge teenage fan base, absolutely beloved. Number one singles all over the shop, and the only thing that stopped them having a Christmas number one was Band Aid in 1984. So yeah, it really does capture that rise to fame, and it's all told through archive footage. It's got recordings of Andrew and George, archive recordings that act as a sort of voiceover narration, but it is all archive footage and quite impressively put together. I mean, there's stuff you've probably seen before, like the Top of the Pops appearance, but then there's like live gigs and backstage footage, shots of them larking around making videos. It's very slickly assembled, and it is the whole Wham! Story from start to finish, kind of compressed very, very tidily.
I think the thing that's interesting about this, I mean, I love it. I love Wham! So I bought Wham! Make It Big on a cassette from Woolworths and played it. I do still have it. I had one of those, you know, those ticker tape things that you used to print out your name and stick them on everything. So I made sure I put that on there so my brother didn't nick it and pretend like it was his. I bought that with my pocket money.
Nice.
So, yeah, they're very dear to my heart. And that album in particular is like a soundtrack to my very young childhood. But the thing that's interesting about this, I think, is often when you get a documentary about a band, it's about the darkness, the egos clashing, the meanness, the falling out, you know, the darker side of it. And this is purely delightful. This is like an absolute salve for all the horror in the world, because Jörg, as George was known to Andrew, and Andrew are like best mates and can't do enough for each other and are having a whale of a time during this.
Yeah.
And the loveliest thing about it is that, you know, obviously George Michael was hiding his sexuality and didn't want to come out, or did want to come out but felt he couldn't. And Ridgely knew that the only way he could set him free to do that really was to let him go and to help him achieve his full potential as a songwriter that he knew he was capable of. And he did that with absolute love. And basically, if you love something, set it free is essentially the mantra of this entire documentary. So from that point of view, I just thought this was such a lovely film to watch. These two guys that absolutely adore each other and only want the best for each other. And that's why it was short-lived. Not because it imploded, not because someone got drunk, not because someone stole all the money or, you know, froze other band members out, but because they both mutually recognised that change and osmosis had to happen. Yeah. And allowed for it and stepped aside for a completely different career path. And that is so heartwarming. But also, as you say, the footage is great. You know, there's like footage of them playing shows where they're wearing the smallest shorts. And George Michael's big thing was taking a shuttlecock and wiping it in his sweaty sort of belly sweat down his pants and then badminton racketing it into the audience. And somebody went home with a sweat-stained, you know, shuttlecock that had been down pants. I get it. Very good. But yeah, really just charming, utterly charming, this film.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's really exhilarating. And I sort of felt a bit sorry for Andrew at times, because you see footage again and again of people interviewing him saying, are you jealous of George? You know, is he overshadowing you? And he genuinely just seems, he says, well, no, that he doesn't. You know, he does recognize that George has this incredible talent, and he still, you know, he still loves him like a brother. So, yeah, like you say, you don't get the kind of bitterness and infighting that we've seen so many times in so many rock and roll stories. It kind of avoids those cliches. So it is just quite refreshing that they did have this kind of meteoric rise, and then it took off in a different direction. And I like the fact that it does just focus solely on Wham as well. It doesn't address George's solo career, which is a whole different beast. And obviously he went on to a whole different level of success, but it does kind of just focus on the two guys. Yeah. You get a little bit of Pepsi and Shirley, but not too much. I mean, I kind of would have liked a bit more of Pepsi and Shirley, if I'm totally honest.
Yeah. As you say, you know, it doesn't sort of go on to George Michael's wider career, but it does really show you the seeds of his abilities here, and the fact that he talks in the narration about how he cannot understand that people would take the piss out of him when he was 20, when he'd written, produced and performed a number one single at the age of 20. And when you think about how young he was when he was writing Careless Whisper and these absolute bangers, it's an amazing achievement. So it really grounds it as well in the fact that, you know, we're not just looking at a throwaway, you know, Stock Aitken Waterman group who didn't write anything and were just sort of, you know, pop stars that were plucked out of obscurity and told to sing something. You know, these songs were written by this band, and particularly by George Michael, and they have stood the test of time. I mean, who doesn't love Careless Whisper? You know, and I think Ross, our producer on this podcast, will no doubt have a gamut of choices to choose for the outro. Oh, I'm just waiting to see which Wham track he chooses. But yeah, it's really interesting. And also interesting to hear sort of, there's a first, he went to Muscle Shoals recording studio to record Careless Whisper in a certain way that the management thought would work. And you hear that version of it and it's dead. It's just not right.
Yeah.
So George Michael came back, he decided to produce it himself, and he tried, you know, 10 different saxophonists to find the right...
Yeah, I love that. I love that bit.
And that's amazing to hear what it could have been and what it is now and the difference and the sparkle that that is. So, I love all that detail. I think this is fun for anyone who grew up with Wham, but also a real insight into 80s music and how people were making it up as they went along. It wasn't slick. It was like signing your contract at a Greasy Spoon cafe and getting on with it and you know, not having enough money for stage clothes and just wearing two pairs of shorts between you and swapping them, you know, things like that. Like, just crazy. I loved it.
Yeah, I did too. Yeah, I just thought, yeah, it's really exhilarating. I mean, I'm an absolute sucker for anything to do with 80s pop. And I wouldn't say Wham were one of, I mean, I love Wham, they're not one of my absolute favourites from that era, but I enjoyed this more than the a-ha documentary. I mean, I'm more of an a-ha fan, but I thought this one was just so like pure joy from start to finish, where the a-ha one's a bit more kind of darker and gloomier and slightly more challenging, perhaps. But yeah, this one, yeah, it's terrific.
So I think we're saying highly recommend going out and seeing that. Take your shuttlecocks, ladies and gentlemen.
And your tiny shorts.
Indeed. So that is Wham. That is Wham, exclamation mark, Wham, as it should be. And it's out in cinemas on Friday. And then it hits Netflix from the 5th of July. See it on a big screen or a small screen, Matthew?
I think big for the music. Yeah. It works perfectly well on the small screen. But yeah, to hear those songs.
You want that Wham rap booming out of a Dolby sound system, don't you?
Well, all of them. They had all bangers, bangers from start to finish. They didn't have a single dud.
Well, I think, Wham Rap.
What would you say?
I would say Wham Rap's down the lower end of the scale.
Right, yeah.
But I had never thought about it as a socio-political song. Mm. And this documentary made me think about it a bit differently. So there we go. It's worked. It's magic. Okay, shall we move on then? We're going to take it from unbridled buoyant joy to something much darker. It's this.
I don't understand what's going on.
It's clear there's something troubling Mia.
I don't want to talk about it. She's pretending to be Alice.
I am Alice.
Please, this isn't a game.
You don't like me. You make me hide and hide.
You're a nasty little thing. You're a good girl.
Where's Mia?
You're a good girl. You're a good girl.
So this is Run, Rabbit, Run, starring Sarah Snook from Succession.
Say that six times fast.
Sarah Snook from Succession. Yes, that one. So, Matthew, set it up for us. There's a rabbit figure in it.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, there's a rabbit. There's an actual rabbit. And there's like a rabbit motif. There's a rabbit mask that runs through this. So yeah, it's not as accurate a title as Ruby Gilman, Teenage Kraken, but it's kind of getting there.
Can't have everything.
No, you can't. Sarah Snook plays a fertility doctor living in Australia with her daughter. And her daughter just begins to behave strangely. She seems to be channeling some sort of spirits or some echoes of the past that relate to some incidents in the past. And there's her grandmother, Sarah Snook's mother, played by Greta Scacchi, who's living in a care home. She has dementia, and she kind of plays a part in this mystery that gradually unravels. And it's all about kind of getting to find out what has happened to these characters in the past, why this girl is behaving so strangely. And obviously things escalate, the behavior gets more troubling. There's injuries, there's pain, there's nightmares, there's ambiguity. You're not sure what's happening to who to believe, whether characters are seeing things or not. So it's one of those type of films.
It's like a Babadook or even a Hereditary.
Hereditary
or Relic. Some of those Australian gothic films with a strong female center. Like those films as well, it does sort of question and delve into, you know, the horror of motherhood and how difficult that is, and mental health issues and guilt and trauma.
Yeah. Not,
without giving anything away. Did you like it? Did it work as well as those films?
No, I don't think it did. I thought similar to Ruby Gilman in a weird way. It just felt very derivative of all those films we've mentioned. I thought Sarah Snook was terrific, as she always is, kind of really committed. It's very nice to see Greta Scacchi, even in a minor role. I felt like it kind of went too far along with the ambiguity. It seems to be just wanting to toy with that without kind of really getting to the meat of what was going on. I didn't find it very scary, but it had the atmosphere wasn't particularly inviting, involving. Yeah, I'd rather go and watch Hereditary again, or especially the Babadook. I thought the Babadook was such a superior example of the kind of troubled mother and child story haunted by the past and perhaps some supernatural figures. And I did find the rabbit stuff a bit comical as well, I have to say. It reminded me of Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the way this rabbit keeps popping up there, here and there. So,
I mean, you did expect that the rabbit would expire in a grisly fashion. That was part of the tension. I have to disagree with you. I admit that it's incredibly derivative. I mean, it's doing everything you've seen previously. You know, cinematography, like True Detective, that very gothic style, the idea of mothers and trauma, and mothers and having children, where you're like, oh, what's going, are you okay, what's going on? And then, should we be frightened of the mother or should we be frightened of the child? Like, what's going on? Is there something falling apart in the mother or the child? I love that, and I think it did it masterfully. I actually was very disquieted by it, much so that I watched it at home and I just popped it on pause for a minute to pop out and get a cup of tea. And in the interim, my husband went and got a pot rabbit that we have in the house, sat it on the seat. And when I came screamed. I screamed like a girl. So it really did actually get under my skin. And I thought it was really sort of atmospheric and intense. And I think, you know, the ambiguity that you speak about, I really enjoyed that, because afterwards we were like, well, did it mean this? Was it that? You know, there's an Alice in Wonderland theme. You know, the child is called Alice.
Yeah.
Are we looking through a looking glass? What is real? What is not? What is a psychotic break? What is haunting? All of these things I found fascinating. And it was like reading a book to me. I was asking questions all the way along, and I truly didn't actually really know where it would end. And to be honest, at the end, you can put any interpretation on it, which I also like.
I was disappointed. I thought it had like some of the visual cliches kind of got on my wick quite a bit, like that classic one of a character banging on a window, but they've like muted the sound, so they're screaming away but no one else can hear them. I feel like I've seen that so many times, and a kid just standing in a corridor with a mask on looking scary. It just all felt a bit familiar to me.
Yeah, I just think it's very well done, and maybe I was just in the right mood for it. But yes,
maybe I was in the wrong one.
This is a Netflix thing, so you know you're not going to have to spend a great deal of money going out to see it. No. You can pop it on whilst you're having your dinner. Would you think it's good for that?
Maybe not during dinner, because you might feel a bit queasy, but. After dinner, perhaps.
There is a scab pulling scene that you probably don't want to watch whilst you're having your dinner. Yeah.
Extreme close up. Yeah, I mean, certainly in Flight, if you're missing Succession, you like Sarah Snook, she's just fantastic. I'd say definitely watch it, give it a go.
I would recommend it. I think it's a bit of quality from Netflix that doesn't involve explosions, and I like to see
franchise
it. So
baiting.
But, you know, and I would suggest if you do have a rabbit at home, stick it somewhere to make someone disquieted and discombobulated during the watching of it. So that is Run, Rabbit, Run. And that is on the Netflix platform right now. So Run, Rabbit, Run to watch that. Okay. So, Matthew, that's all the films we've got time to talk about this week. Film of the week. Which one are you recommending people spend their pennies on?
Oh, well, I can't believe I'm saying this. In a week, we've got Indiana Jones and animation, which I love, but I'm going to go for Wham, unexpectedly. The Wham documentary. Yeah.
I would highly recommend that as well, but I do think for a event movie, you can't go wrong with Indiana Jones, whether you love it, hate it, feel very met about it. It's an event movie, so I would suggest you go out and see that one. Right, a reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press that button now and we will just like fall into your ears. Like a spider or something whilst you sleep. That's a horrible thing to say, but there we are.
What a lovely image.
And
I'm going to sleep tonight.
Yeah.
Looking at some spiders.
Crawling into your ear, like one of those bugs in Star Trek, the Ratokan. Just crawling in there. Yeah. Also, just a reminder that the new issue is on sale now. Heart of Stone is on the cover. We're also covering Mission Impossible, Ahsoka, and the greatest stunts ever. Do buy that one. Okay. We'll be back next week with more. But before we go, we've got time for a listener's question. What is Indiana Jones's greatest moment in the series so far? Matthew?
That's a big one, isn't it? So many to choose from the three movies in the Indiana Jones franchise. I mean, the obvious one, I suppose, the most iconic one is the boulder chase, outrunning the boulder in Raiders. That's the kind of the big action moment. But in terms of my favourite moment, can I say my favourite moment?
Yes, please do.
My thing. Well, the one that always gets me is in Temple of Doom, when Indy and Short Round give each other's hats back to each other after, you know, Indy's been possessed by the devil and done all sorts of terrible things, and Short Round's burned him back to normality. And then they give each other their hats. And I think only Spielberg could pull off something so nakedly sentimental like that. But yeah, I love that moment.
Mm. I mean, my favourite is Raiders of the Lost Ark. No competition. Mm. It's just a cracker. And so I would say that my favourite moment is that classic moment that is sort of reprised in Dial of Destiny, where he's surrounded by people and a man comes with a sword and starts swishing it about. And he's just, because at the time he was so terribly down with food poisoning and everything else, he was supposed to have this big fight, he just pulls his gun out and shoots him. And it's so sort of played for laughs, when actually, if you think about that, that's not okay, is it? Just shooting people dead. And it's a bit unfair. It's not really cricket. But it's so played for laughs and it's so casually cool.
Yeah.
And just really sums up who Indy is. Like, you know, he's just going to get the job done. I love that bit. And in terms of favourite bit, I always loved when they opened the Ark of the Covenant and the ghosties come out and it face melts the Nazis. It's so good. And I love the fact that that's, you know, this is what we're talking about in Dial of Destiny. That's all CG. You could do that beautifully now with CG, but it wouldn't have the same effect as a physical effect where you've got a head that's covered in loads of wax that they've painstakingly melt over time and then they speed up for the film, or a head that explodes, or a chin that really elongates with rubber. That is visceral, and I have never forgotten it, and I still take great delight in watching it. So yeah, that's what I would say about the Dial of Destiny. More of that stuff, guys, and less of the weird.
That's what was missing.
Should have had a face that went really long. After
nudged it up a star.
Yeah, that would have made it a 5-starer.
When I was 6, it didn't scare me at all. I just thought it was really cool. But as I've got older, I find it absolutely terrifying. Mm-hmm. All these angels of death flying around and God's wrath kind of raining down on everybody. I just find that more and more scary as the years go past. Whereas when I was a kid, I just thought, wow, this is so cool. I love all this light show.
Yeah.
But now,
well, now that mortality is stalking you, Matthew, like the opening of death is something that hits different, right?
Yeah, I think it does. I think you're right.
Okay. Well, on that somber note, let's say goodbye and we will be back next week and we'll see what track that we get played out with. Are you ready? Say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.